You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest on this hour is Corinne Eisenman. Corinne, it's good to have you here.
Thank you, Eric. It's lovely to be here.
So the way we start this show is with a big question, so we can start this conversation getting to know each other. Who are you? What do we need to know about the life you aspire to live, the places you've been, the labels you wear to get this conversation going?
Yeah, that's a big question. I am someone who really loves looking at communities in all ways. So I live in a beautiful off-grid house that my partner designed and built. It's a timber frame with slate roof and water catchment, and we walk a quarter mile back into the driveway. And I love that because I get to see who lives there with me. So there's fox tracks and bobcat tracks and coyote and raccoons and turkeys. And so I love the natural communities and all the trees and the edible plants that are there. And I also work with a lot of communities, and that's been pretty much my whole life, working in meaningful, heart-centered, transformational-based programs that help folks find their own connection to themselves and mm-hmm. to other people and to the earth.
Mm-hmm. And okay, that just like went really, really into a very clear space in the values. How did you discover yourself living there?
Oh, what a fun question. I am so blessed to have had connection to the outdoors most of my life. Oh, and I get teary when I talk about things that matter to me. So mm-hmm. it doesn't mean there's anything wrong. It just
means that I'm connected. You've been emotionally moved.
Yeah, I'm really connected to what matters. So my family really loved the outdoors, and we didn't have a lot of money, which means that we spent a lot of time exploring in our backyards and in the state parks. And one of the funnest things was in the summer when it was 6 o'clock, we would be at the gate because that's when you didn't have to pay to get into the park anymore. Mm-hmm. And then we had a scavenger hunt to find the grill that had the most hot coals so that we could go and cook our picnic dinner. So I think even from a small child in my family of origin, I had that sense of delight and fun and community and connectedness mm-hmm. to the outdoors. And then I proceeded to be part of community-based professional settings like Girl Scouting and the YMCA and mm-hmm. environmental ed centers. And the more I worked in those intensive settings that had a real mission that really served people in transforming a bit of who they were and how they saw the world, the more I got really hooked and the more I saw change happen in a way that I wanted to be part of. Uh-huh. And so that's just taken different formats throughout my entire life.
Wow. Well, that's really neat. Okay. So what should we open with musically?
That's a good question. Let's do the Kursky Funk. I think that's a great one to start with.
Yeah. You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest on this hour is Corinne Eisenman. So, Corinne, I am fascinated by this trajectory of a story, and I almost don't know where to begin with the next question. So let me use the usual question, and then I have a couple that I would really love to go to.
Sure.
So what did you have to learn? You know, you started out with an appreciation for living on the remnant, the thing left behind, the last piece, making it work, stretching it out, working within the yeah. available possibilities. When did you learn that that isn't just a survival mechanism, but that is a beautiful thing? Because in our culture, a lot of times when we start out that way, we don't know. It's our way our family has coped to make it good, but it was making it good rather than being good. When did it become yeah. good for you? Or did you ever have to make that transition?
You know, I think I'm really fortunate in that I never felt like that was
There wasn't another standard outside.
Yeah. Nope. Yeah. And even now, I feel really blessed that I know how to have a lot of fun and a lot of connection without having to have a lot of money. And I'm really fortunate. I've never looked for work. The right job has always come to me. Mm-hmm. And it's almost always a not-for-profit or an organization that is in service to you. So I'm not having a huge income for a lot of my life, although sometimes I have a large income.
Right.
And I spend what I have. So if I have more money, I might go out to dinner more.
Right.
And if
right.
I don't, I am so grateful that I know how to make a home-cooked meal and that being outside is easy.
Right, right. And that's consistent with living within your means.
Sure.
Does it also entail the kind of the living with nature where you put things away for the future? You know, whether it's for years ahead or savings or food or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
How does it translate into that aspect of your life?
Yeah, that's a good question. I'm very much aware of what's happening in the moment.
Mm-hmm.
I know just about when the first red-winged blackbird is going to come back, and I know when to find edible plants.
Right, because you're watching all the things that lead up to that particular thing happening.
Yeah, and I do a little bit of preservation, mm-hmm. but not as much. It's more about being really present with what's there,
mm-hmm.
almost to a fault. I could be better about saying, and what do I need to put away for the future?
Right, right. But I mean, these are skills, and not everybody has every skill. And what you have is being incredibly resourceful with what's in front of your face. And a lot of
yeah.
us are blind to what's in front of our faces. And what about the way your parents created the space for you to emerge in that allowed you to be unselfconsciously present?
Yeah, that's a beautiful way to say that. They were very curious, and they encouraged us to be curious, and whatever we were interested in, we were welcome as kids to explore.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this is true in most cases with siblings, but we're very different. I loved
school.
How many
siblings do you have?
I have two, so there's three of us mm-hmm. total, and I'm the oldest. And I loved school and sort of did the classic school thing, and I did a lot of extracurricular activities, and my brother didn't like school at all, but was really smart. And so when he left, he went and worked with his hands out west where he could snowboard because that's what he really loved.
Uh-huh.
And he's brilliant. Mm-hmm. And my sister and I both think so. And my sister liked school okay, but she was really interested in family. And so after a little bit of time in college, she decided that wasn't what she wanted to do. Not a little bit of time. She was a semester away from graduating, but it wasn't what she wanted to
right.
do. So she left. And my parents said, great, you know, whatever it is we mm-hmm. want to do, they're supportive. And I think that...
And what does she do? What does she do?
So she got married mm-hmm. and had two wonderful kids. And now she works for a school district and takes care of all of the health insurance and all of the payroll for all of the teachers in the whole school district.
So it's still a very analytical kind of mind-oriented job, but it's still... But she wanted to live this embodied and reproductive life early on.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. So my parents really encouraged us and supported us and participated with mm-hmm. us as they walked toward with us as much as they could.
Right. And so the word that I understand from character studies is that the virtue associated most closely with curiosity is humility.
Mm.
And I'm wondering, you know, how, and the way that you were raised kind of going to find where the most charcoal was still available to cook your stuff. That is a very humble way to be.
Yeah.
And you go out and you discover whatever is, because you have little to, or nothing, and you wait to be filled by what you find.
Yeah. And the flip side of that is you have everything that you need almost all the time.
Right.
And everybody that you encounter could be either a friend or a teacher. And so there's...
And both relationships have tremendous value.
Yeah.
And you can also teach, but it's within the context of collaborating as
yes.
a friend.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. So I think both things are true. One is that you can make much of little, but you can see much in what might not be visible to other
anybody,
people.
Yeah. And are your parents still alive?
They are. Yeah. My mom, they're divorced and mm-hmm. both remarried. And my mom's in Western New York near where we grew up. I grew up on the Seneca Reservation, actually, in uh-huh. Salamanca, New York. I'm not Seneca, but
right.
I grew up there. And my dad lives in Syracuse with his wife.
Mm-hmm. So, and they found other relationships. Yeah.
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 Neat. Yeah. So how did you actually you brought some music along with you. We're going to take a little break now, play some more music, and then I've got a couple of more questions to follow up on this line of thinking.
Okay.
What should we play
great.
Next?
Let's play Breaths.
And do you want to say anything about that?
Sure. It's a sweet Honey in the Rock song. And I love how they blend their voices and their harmonies and the rhythms and sounds as well as words. And this song in particular is about how we're all part of everything.
Mm-hmm.
So that fits in.
Listen more often to things than to beings. 'Tis the ancestor's breath when the fire's voice is heard. 'Tis the ancestor's breath in the voice of the waters. Those who have died have never left. The dead are not under the earth. They are in the rustling trees. They are in the groaning woods. They are in the crying grass. And they are in the moaning rocks. The dead are not under the earth. So I listen no more often to things than to. Listen more often to things than to beings. 'Tis the ancestor's breath when the fire's voice is heard. 'Tis the ancestor's breath in the voice of the waters. Listen no more often to things than to beings. Listen no more often to things than to beings. 'Tis the ancestor's breath when the fire's voice is heard. 'Tis the ancestor's breath in the voice of the water.
Miriam Makeba, Nina Simone, Odetta, Sarah Vaughan, Ella Fitzgerald, Billie Holiday,
Abby Lincoln,
Carmen McGarry, Lily Simon,
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest on this hour is Corinne Eisenman. So Corinne, you discovered as you were working that people were making connections in their lives and things, and to you and becoming, I The interpretation that I had was more grounded, more more themselves.
Right, they're more available to themselves, yeah. Right.
And that is traditionally a role of a coach or a healer. Mm-hmm. And yet you kind of have just kind of walked into that role. When did you discover that this was your vocation?
It's interesting to look back and see that I think I've always done that.
Well, you may have
work
done it, but
as
yeah,
a healer.
Yeah.
But claiming it has been a real journey and still is, honestly. It's back to the humility question.
Uh-huh. Yep.
Who am I to say that I have that to bring to the world?
You offer a container. You offer a space. You offer,
yeah.
Or you offer a relationship and you don't know what's going to happen. So when did you discover that you could do that with some reliability, not predictability, but with some reliability?
Yeah, I think it's been the most significant journey probably in the last 10 years. Mm-hmm. And I know that when I am working with a group of people or an individual and I get quiet and I connect to myself and I really listen to them and we go where we both feel called, that something good is going to happen and that both of our perspectives are going to change. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And the result of that is, you could call it healing, you could call it education, it's an increase in awareness that gives everybody more choice.
Right. And you can call it also living into the wonder.
Yeah, I love that.
It is a process of life as an ongoing discovery.
Yeah.
So what has been the issue with humility? What has made it challenging for you to accept that piece of yourself and wear it openly as a label? I share a similar challenge.
Yeah. I think it's on two levels. One is, I've always worked with organizations that have really beautiful missions, and I can stand up with an organization or for an organization and claim that the organization does beautiful work, but to do that just for myself is much more vulnerable, edgy territory, partly because I don't want to overclaim
what my skill is,
and partly because I think when we get that close to something that's that meaningful, the core of us, it's very alive, it's very tender, mm-hmm. and embodying that as my identity rather than the organizations that I've served for 30 years is really beautiful territory. So mm-hmm. I'm doing that more and more and claiming my role as a healer and a teacher of a healing modality as my lead, mm-hmm. rather than my more
institutional role.
Yes, correct.
Right, right. So what I'm really curious about is how have many people for whom healing is almost second nature find much of institutional or organizational life constraining because it does not allow the kind of freedom to interact, to engage, because of the norms of an organization. How was your way of embracing the organization different, or how were the organizations that you embraced different?
Yeah.
So you weren't kind of poisoned by that thing. I say on the show often that we have to have institutions and organizations. They provide the scaffolding on which we build lives, but they're also the platforms from which we're lynched.
Yeah.
And they're both. So they're kind of this neutral, they can be very positive, very negative, but they seem to be a very reverential almost function for you.
Yeah, I think it's a mix of choice, mm-hmm. and good fortune that I have only ever worked for mission-based places that share values and are interested in encouraging thought and evolution and connection. And so,
and self-critical enough that they can do their own reflection about the dark, the more difficult side, the harmful side of it.
Yes. And in most cases, proactively so. And in some cases, a little bit reluctantly, mm-hmm. and still willing to do that hard work so that we can continue to evolve and grow and meet whatever's next to be in service to. And I think I got clear really early on that I don't really want to work for any place that doesn't share the values that I do. And I will adjust my lifestyle such that the work that I want to do in the world sustains me.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. remind me, let's go back to that value question later. But as you step outside, in a certain sense, an institution or an organization provides a nest from which to operate, and that image. But when you don't need the nest anymore, so to speak, you become a different kind of bird. So how has your identity changed as you've given up that reference point or rely on it far less?
Yeah. I always used to say I wanted to be sexy and sophisticated, and what I am is cute and nice. And for years, that was the case in my 20s and 30s. And I have realized that I am, it's not an either or. I'm actually all of those right. things.
And more.
And more. Yeah. And I can step into them and own that sort of unabashedly.
Right.
And I think when we get to that point where we can both claim the parts that we really love or aspire to and the parts that we think, really? then there's a different level of confidence from which we can pivot to meet whatever's in front of us.
Right, right, right. I mean, it's what it means to be graceful.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, our definition of balance in this tradition is the ability to fall in any direction, uh-huh. which is the sense of grace.
And to fall right? with safety.
Yeah.
Because when you are falling gracefully, you're not likely to get hurt.
Right. I mean,
when you're playing volleyball and you take that leap where you hit the ball and catch
right.
yourself and roll, I mean, you're not going to get hurt when you know what you're doing and you're graceful.
Yeah.
That's very, very, very powerful. What did you have to go through to accept? What kinds of experiences made it possible for you to accept that you could, the way the Shaker hymns, to turn will be our delight, till by turning we come round right, you know, and you can bow and bend and do all these things that it implies and not be ashamed. What helped you to come through to the point where you're not ashamed, which is what gets in people's way most often?
I think the first thing that comes to mind is that I've had brilliant mentors, just incredible role models, modeling the way, demonstrating both skillfulness and competence and a sense of ego that is not in the way of anything. So they'll confidently move toward what they feel is right in the moment. Mm-hmm. And then if somebody brings a question to their attention, they'll sit back and say, oh, let's look at that differently. Mm-hmm. And I've watched enough people in my life. There was one at the Environmental Ed Center that I worked with who still I think of as my greatest teacher. And he would just model that, and mm-hmm. he would encourage me to step into that. And the more responsibility I took with his coaching and his mm-hmm. Invitation, the more I could occupy myself and see, oh, this really serves. And I can also say I made a mistake, and it doesn't lessen the respect mm-hmm. that I'm sure. receiving from the people that I'm supervising or working with. It actually builds it more. Right. And so that was John Haskin. He's one of my mentors. And that happened in several other places where I feel like I got modeled and then given opportunity to try and mm-hmm. succeed and also to make a little mess of things and recover and still be an asset. One of my other mentors, Andy Winter, said, I helped start an expedition-based high school program mm-hmm. that was mm-hmm. beautiful. It was the entry requirement was that the students could not have been successful in traditional school settings. Mm-hmm. So these were all the kids that were really smart. They could do lots of things, but not in a traditional way.
Sure.
So they just had to demonstrate commitment to something. Anything could be basketball mm-hmm. to join mm-hmm. us. And it was hard. It was expedition-based. We were designing a curriculum that would be meaningful. One of our graduation requirements was that every kid should know how to save a life. That mm-hmm. seemed like something worthy.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But it was a lot of work in this early years. So I said to Andy, I don't know if I can do it. I'm not showing up the way that I think I should for these kids. And he said to me, what if your 70% is more than many people put in on a top day at work? And what if 70% of your intention is 70% better than nothing?
Right, right. And what if 30% is all that's required today?
Yeah.
So you can modulate moderate yourself and adjust.
Yeah.
Neat. So let's cut to music. What should we play next?
Sure.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest on this hour is Corinne Eisenman.
Let's play the song for my grandma.
Oh, okay. And do you want to describe it before we play it or after?
I'll describe it before.
Okay. Yes.
So, let's see. So this song is a song by David Wilcox, who's a fairly well-known folk artist who I've loved for decades, literally. And my grandma is one of the dearest people in my world, and she and I traveled together for about 25 years. She just died last year. And we traveled last to Asheville, North Carolina in 2014, and she flew. She was 95. She flew, and we met for a long weekend, and we just had the best time, and we were looking for something to do in the evenings. We went to the Biltmore Estate and traveled around the gardens, but there was a paper that had Dave Wilcox concert, and I said, Graham, do you want to go see this? And she said, well, if it's your favorite person, by all means, let's go. So it was not a concert. It was a show called the Magical Medicine Show or something like that, and it was an intimate setting, and Dave Wilcox would invite people up to the stage, and he would ask them a question, and they would answer, and he might ask a different question, and he'd say, okay, I think we have a song. And they would sit down, and he would stand there and just in his t-shirt and jeans and stare off into space, and he would play with some chords. And then he would say, 90 seconds later, I think we have a song. And he would begin singing, and he would sing a song for these people. And he did this for 2.5 hours.
Wow.
And some were short and funny, and some were long and touching. And people were talking about things that mattered to them. And one guy got up and said, I'm here with this, the most amazing woman in my life. And I thought, how blessed am I to be there with one of the most amazing women in my life? So I raised my hand and I went up and I told a story about my Graham and how we traveled together. We've been many places in our travels, Alaska and Venezuela and Thailand. And she took flying lessons when she was 18. She and my grandfather both were flying. But she, at 95, think about that time. Mm-hmm. Women were not flying much. Yeah. But they only had enough money for my grandpa to get his license. So he got to be the pilot and she did not. So I told this short story to him and he wrote this song.
Of the people that have walked those paths forever, but the feeling appears brand new. 'Cause I can see the ways that I've gone, and I can see how from now on I know a shortcut to this place. And it's in the picture that I carry in the back of my mind, of this smiling face. And you are the girl who flew so boldly, you're the woman who flew wise, you're the grandma who takes me on these journeys through this life, and you're the one who I will cherish for as long as I'm alive, 'cause you taught me how to fly.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca. This is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest is Corinne Eisenman, and that was the song about her grandma.
Yeah, it was so beautiful, and so many people came up to us afterwards, and there was a man who had filmed it, and he came up and said, if you give me your email, I will send you that beautiful song. So he did, which is lovely. And the whole experience was beautiful, but when you asked me the question about how did I know that you could just, that I could just step out and be more of myself, mm-hmm. without being ashamed or without being worried,
sure.
of falling, the way he framed this whole concert was beautiful. He said to everybody, we're going to do something that's impossible. We're going to do something that people think is nuts, and we're going to do it together. And my friends, this is like the first pancake. It's a cold room. We got to get it going. We got to believe. And he really did. And you mentioned that you thought it was like rapping. And it is. The way he described it was that he just surrendered to the flow. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. he'd done his preparation in terms of he knew music really well. Right. And he was a good listener. And he was looking for a contradiction from which to move.
Sure. Yeah.
And then he just surrendered. And I just think that's such a beautiful life philosophy.
Right. And I want to just play with that.
Yeah.
He was looking for a contradiction from which to move, mm-hmm. if I am quoting back to you your words.
Yeah.
We can look at the contradictions in our lives as paradoxes, as hypocrisies, as occasions for shame and judgment, or we can look at them as the wonder of some things that should not fit together, but damn it, they do.
Right, or that don't, and therefore we have to actually make choice and claim our roles right. in our lives.
And in different settings, in different yeah. ways, and that we have multiple capacities and multiple identities that we live yeah. out of. Whether we live them all at the moment or not doesn't really matter, but they are who we are.
Right, yeah. right. Yeah.
How have you been stretched? How has your heart had to grow to sizes that you would not have known you could in the work that you've needed to engage people as they learn and grow?
Yeah. Boy, my kids at Shackleton at the expedition-based high school program that we started, they were such great teachers. And I think that was a big example of it. When did I go to Shackleton? Yeah, so that followed. So I'll tell another story first. Sure. When I graduated from college, my best friend's aunt was the country director of the Peace Corps in Sri Lanka. And so we flew to meet her. Mm-hmm. She was missing family. So we were in Germany the day the wall came down. That was it. It was an auspicious wow. year. Wow. And we flew from Munich to Sri Lanka. And when we landed there, I thought I was cultured. I thought I knew a lot about traveling. I'd been to Europe a couple times. I'd studied when I was in college. But they were all Judeo-Christian countries that spoke Latin-based languages. So I could speak a little French, I could speak a little Spanish, I could speak a little German.
You could get by.
I could get by. And then we landed in Sri Lanka, and most of those... yeah. So we landed in Sri Lanka and the weather was different. I could not read the signs in the airport. They're in Sinhala, mm-hmm. these mm-hmm. squiggly characters. And we got out of the airport and we're on a 6-lane highway And those, they were not six fixed lanes. It would go from 2 and 4 to 3 and 3 and 1 and 5. Whoever could push the hardest. And there were lorries and there were ox carts and there were tuk-tuks and cars. And I was holding on to the edges of my seat. And then I saw a woman walking, carrying a yoke with water. And I remember thinking, we have to help these people. And then we went home to her house. And it was a hard time politically. And the JVP, there was a conflict in that moment. And so we had to sit below the windowsills because of stray bullets. And so in that 24 hours, my whole perspective of what is life and what is known really, really opened and really shifted. And we were there for 2 months visiting Peace Corps volunteers in remote parts of the country. And when I left, I had this whole other appreciation for different perspectives. And isn't it funny that now I carry my water by hand where I want to go? And I think in terms of heart opening, it's a perspective opening that there's much more that's unknown and mystery than is known. And isn't that actually a beautiful thing rather than a threatening thing? And I don't need to narrow the world to make it be known.
Right. And I don't know, did you say before that you're off the grid, but you also are, you don't have plumbing, you're carrying water.
Right. I carry all my drinking water a quarter mile down my driveway and my wash water isn't from rainwater catchment.
Yeah. And it also helps me to see the reflexes. You want to help them, and what they end up doing is helping you.
Yeah, definitely.
And it also helps me to kind of understand the, and there is a quality of unself-conscious innocence in your engagement. I grew up around more violence. So 1 out of 20 of my peers wouldn't make it to the age of 20.
And
I have been, and I've worked in emergency rooms in Washington Heights and crack epidemic, and I've in emergency rooms in a regional trauma center, and I've just been around a lot of violence. And that changes. We share much of the healing stuff and much of the wonder, but mine is against a backdrop of institutions that fail. And what you went into in Sri Lanka, in some way, is what I came from. And yet I have in my head the image of Dami Harath, who was from, who's here and is from Sri Lanka, and the way she kind of holds those multiple realities.
Yeah. And then I went from there to start this expedition-based high school program, which had a lot of kids from backgrounds like that, which was, I think, another opening of my perspective. These were kids from inner city Boston, inner city New York City, and rural Washington State. So there was this huge mix of cultures and diverse backgrounds. And one of my kids was from Haiti, and he would talk about being called back because there was going to be gang violence, and he was being called on to be part of that, and he was really in the
be
dilemma.
A soldier in the violence.
How to work with that. And then in the healing work that I do now, people's stories, you know, there's a lot of hurt and pain in the world, and there's a lot of violence that's happening on lots of levels.
Right. And how did you find yourself being with the violence? You're not so much with the violence as you are, you're with the aftermath of the violence. How did you find that affected how you were with them? What did it draw out of you that other settings didn't, or draws more of than other settings?
Yeah. I think it requires me to show up with even more authenticity and to find my edges, which I'm known for being all expansive, embracing, whatever setting I can create the environment from which people can feel safe.
Stretching to the eternal horizon.
Yeah. And there's a way that finding my edges is necessary, both for me in my own life,
right,
and for me to do the work,
right,
with these other populations.
Whose edges have been sharply chiseled and cut and shot.
Yeah, I meet anyone where they are, which is really one of, I think, my tenets. Mm-hmm. I want to see you as you are and where you are, and let's from there figure where we can go together.
Right.
And if that's not in my vocabulary, if that's not in my repertoire, mm-hmm. then I can't meet you in the same way. So I feel like my students at Shackleton and my healing students now in particular have really opened those venues in a way that I hadn't had. I'm blessed. I'm fortunate in my life to not have had those experiences in some way.
Right. No. And it allows you to bring this just openness to the relationship, where those of us who began with more tied up in more knots because of the violence around us.
Yeah.
It's a different sort of thing. But what's really neat is it's also a clearly kindred spirit.
Yeah.
And that's very powerful. What should we play next musically?
Let's play Pour à Fait.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest on this hour is Corinne Eisenman. So, Corinne, the way we kind of close out the last segment of the show is to explore what you do to take care of yourself emotionally, intellectually, and physically throughout the day and every daily, weekly, monthly, yearly, so that you have a sense of balance, centered. You're ready to face the world. And how do you know you need to do it?
That is the key question.
You're perfectly able to do it, but you don't always realize you need to do it.
That's right. That's right. And I think that's sort of the practice, right? To get closer and closer to the edge before falling over the edge and realizing that I need to do something.
Well, yeah. And as you push skill to the edge, you're going to be more skillful.
Sure. Yeah. The more aware we are of what are those signs mm-hmm. of, oh, I need something. So I start my day almost every day. I walk out to my pond and I greet the sunrise. I wake up with the sun. And mm-hmm. so I go out and I greet the directions and I offer gratitude. And I say the Thanksgiving address basically in my own words. I got to see the 13 grandmothers when they came mm-hmm. to town in 2008. And they really changed my whole perspective on being in the world. So I start my
how day. So? I mean, and how did they change your perspective? What do you?
They are these incredibly strong women from all around the world, and all of them come from a tradition of gratitude and prayer. So mm-hmm. every mealtime, one of them would stand up and offer prayer, and they all started with gratitude. And I got really curious about how can you talk for 5 minutes about things you're thankful for? I mean, I'm pretty thankful, but 5 minutes? Uh-huh. So I started just practicing it, walking down the road. And I found that my awareness of the things around me popped because mm-hmm. I had a purpose here.
Right.
And I've taken a lot of classes at Tracker School, and they talk about the coming of the red skies, and there's a doom side to it mm-hmm. that's really hard. Fear-based doesn't really motivate me. It does some people, but it doesn't work for me.
Right.
And these women said, oh, yes, you need to learn how to make fire and how to find food and mm-hmm. water. The earth is in rebirth, and birth is painful, and there's life on the other side. Mm-hmm. So a similar message in what's happening, but from a very different perspective.
Right, right. The fear button, I have a very high tolerance for conflict, and I don't go to fear. When I go to fear, it's not a pretty thing, and it takes a while to come back out of it. I think it's the same lesson. But it's an opportunity. It's a birth. The birth pangs of our existence.
Right. It's not that there's not going to be challenge right. or hardship. So that was just transformative for me. It was just when I was leaving the massage school, and it helped inform the choices that I made going forward. I decided to live in right livelihood and learn what mm-hmm. I could for a couple of years. And then I moved toward my current professions.
So part of taking care of yourself is reframing the context of the crisis in which we live.
Yes, every day, every mm-hmm. day. It doesn't mean that I put my head in the sand, but it says what I have impact on is what's in my sphere of influence. And mm-hmm. what's my sphere of influence today? And it might be the person that I meet in the laundromat,
mm-hmm.
or it might be writing a letter to a senator, or it might be just contesting a conversation with people that I don't even know with right. curiosity and saying, can I offer a different viewpoint? Because I don't know who they know.
Right.
But it's being the best person that I can be moving toward that which I want to create in the world.
Right, right. And in these times and in this place, we are so liable to be too intellectual and to want to turn into words and written and spoken things, things that are gestures and ought to never be given word to, but given expression to.
Mm.
And so what I see in your description of yourself and your siblings is there's a tremendous amount of visceral, nonverbal kind of interaction and communication. How do you use that in your role of engaging the world in a way to restore yourself and the people you meet?
Yeah. It's a great question. I think I am nourished when I see other people finding solid ground under their feet.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's beautiful that I get the work that I do also feeds me.
Mm-hmm.
So part of that is choosing work and then fully seeing the people in front of me.
Right.
And asking what matters to you and how do we get there
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
to the best of my ability.
Right. And seeing solid ground under their feet. So that's you're working in a school setting where you have to use words, but you're also using an image of ground under their feet that you're interpreting their physical behavior as though it reveals what they actually got in the ways that words are not true.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or
so
complete.
I'm embodying that in my own body to the best of my ability. Mm-hmm. Some days I'm better at that than others. And I trust that for every word that I'm saying, I'm communicating through a whole other set of wisdom in our bodies, the information that I want to get across, which is part content and it's part way of being, because mm-hmm. I think it's true for any setting, whether it's a business room or a business meeting where I'm facilitating, or it's teaching earth connection skills, mm-hmm. that if we are moving from our most connected and rooted place, we have a higher level of awareness and a larger skill set to draw from. So if I can occupy that and invite that out and really mm-hmm. move from curiosity, then we're all in a place where something can happen a lot faster than defending a particular perspective.
Right, right, right. And oftentimes it's accompanied by gestures. I once had the opportunity to interview Fred Kahn, who deregulated, helped lead the deregulation of the airline industry to lower the cost of flights. And what he said, when people come into my office, they have to take their shoes off and leave them at the door. And we meet in our sock feet. And that levels, that makes us more human with each other. He's also very involved in theater. But I see those similar kinds of attentions to gestures and the nonverbal communication as communicating powerfully.
Yeah.
What needs to happen.
Yeah, I think that's true.
So when did you become aware that, or how did you come into awareness that your self-care is your task as much as your other care? How did you come into awareness that both are part of your life work?
Yeah, that's been a gradual process mm-hmm. over time, and it's been a real stop and start, literally stop. There have been two or three jobs now that I loved, including Shackleton, this exhibition-based high school program that I started, that I completely lost my health for. They were 24/7 sort of residential, high-stress, entrepreneurial.
So you didn't know your edges.
I didn't know my edges. Yeah. And if I did, I chose the mission over me.
Right. That's where the institution...
Because both of those...
That's where the institution lynched you.
Yes, yeah. It's true. And I've come to learn that it's actually not in service to the organization to continue
that
past
happen.
That,
sure. Yeah.
Because then it's not sustainable and they lose their good people. So that's been this long journey for me of having to listen to my body because it put full stops on. And now I just, I really feel more available, more able to serve when I am at capacity. Mm-hmm. So one of the things that we talked about at the massage school is the care of the caregiver.
Right.
And if we're not in a situation to offer our skills aren't really worth much.
Right.
So, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So you've learned this in waves, and it sounds like the more recent getting out of balance at work has been kind of the bigger, most recent lessons. Or
yeah, I think the last of those was when I left the massage school. I had worked too much and I wasn't getting enough outside time. Mm-hmm. And I knew after that I could not do that again, that my physical body would not be as resilient as it was. I've always recovered really quickly mm-hmm. from those. Mm-hmm. And I just knew in a very intrinsic sense that was my last shot at that kind of lifestyle.
Right, right. So I guess...
But that was 10 years ago now.
Right, okay. And then that's what I was losing kind of track of what the timeline was. But there's a sense at a certain age where we almost enjoy playing chicken with our ability to outlast the struggles we find ourselves
yeah.
in. But at some point, chicken becomes a not fun game.
Right. I agree with you. Yeah.
How did your way of relating to other people change as you couldn't take it out on yourself so much?
I think it actually contributes to me inviting people to take up their own space more too, because there's more space available if I'm not feeling like I have to fill all the holes.
You don't have to do it, yeah.
Right.
Right.
And so that's been really, it's been really lovely. And I do think there's something to this transition where what called me and what I really felt compelled to do until I was in my mid-30s, is mm-hmm. really different than what calls me now in the form. Mm-hmm. I think the feel of it is the same, but I want time to myself wandering in the woods.
Right, right.
And I need it differently than I needed it before.
Right. And so are you talking about the woods calling you? Or how does your work call you in a way that's different now? How would you describe that difference?
I am clearer about what it is that I do and what I want to offer folks, and my edges are clear in helping people get there faster to the best of my ability, because mm-hmm.
I'm not so interested in or in need of as gradual a ramp in.
Right.
Perhaps.
Right. Right. Well, you're more confident in how you can be a force to be reckoned with sooner, I would guess, and knowing how to do that in a gentle way, but also direct.
I think that's true. I also think I'm just not interested in waiting. If somebody's not ready or interested to do the work, that's totally fine. But I am.
Right.
And so right. I'm and happy to just move on. Yeah.
Right. And we're not. And so in this is one of the themes of the show. In a covenant relationship, we do for others what they cannot do for themselves. Mm. But we don't do for them what they can do for themselves, because that's our thing. But there are times when what I have to offer isn't appropriate for what the other person needs. So we can't meet on that level. We may meet on something else. And that's just fine. That's why we have communities.
Yeah.
That's why we are redundant.
Right.
Because we're not perfectly redundant. We are, but we have many people with lots of different skills, and somebody else can take that one on. And if you're confident about somebody else taking it on, then you can bless the person on their way.
That's right.
And if you're not confident, then you curse them on their way. Because, you know, you don't have any idea how this is going to work out.
That's
and you
right.
don't have any trust.
That's
and
right.
And what we need to do is to bless each other on our way. Pardon the little sermon there, but
no, I think that's right on. I think that's right on. And the other thing that occurs to me is that I just am unapologetic for what I want to do in the world right now. So it's I feel like I've been doing similar work my whole life journey, and now it's just really clear, and that it can look many different ways.
Right.
And it's really the same work of connection and authenticity.
And you have the clarity of expression that you can communicate really well to people. It's taken me a long time to give up the academic and the intellectual knots. I mean, part of me, I have an MDiv and a PhD, and those are paths that take you into intellectual expressions that are not integrated mind, heart, and body. And the mind, heart, and body integrated communication is what works with people. And I've had to kind of disentangle, and it's hard.
Yeah.
So I understand what you're saying, and that's beautiful in terms of how you've done it. Corinne, it is wonderful to get to know you.
Oh, my pleasure. You too, Eric. Thank you.
And what should we close with? What should we close the show with?
How about, let's do Love is the Key, Tuck and Patty.
Do you know how much you love me? How many hearts you've lifted? Do you know your love is healing? Such a beautiful feeling. Do you know your love is precious? It warms me like the shining sun. I keep shining through the darkest season. Your life has such a perfect reason. In a world of sadness and strife, you could help change somebody's life. If love has made a difference to you, help somebody else believe that is true. Love is a key, and take it from me, show your love. Your love means, oh, do you know how many hearts you've lifted? Do you know your love is a healer and such a beautiful feeling? Oh, do you know your love is precious? It warms me like the shining sun. Oh, keep shining through the darkest season. Your life has such a perfect reason. In a world of sadness and strife, you could help to change somebody's life. Oh, if love has made a difference to you, help somebody else believe that is true. Love is a key, and take it from me, show your love. You've got to show it, say it now. Keep shining like the sun, say. Keep
keep shining like a rainbow around me. Keep shining like the sun will say now. Love keeps shining all around me. Oh, love. Love keeps shining all around me like moonbeams on a starry night. Oh, say in a world sadness and strife, you could help to change somebody's life. Oh, if love has made a difference to you, help somebody else believe that is true. Yes, love is a key, and take it from me, show your love. You've got to show, you've got to show your love. Say the love is a key, oh, won't you believe, show your love. You've got to show, you've got to show your love. Say the love is a key, listen to me, show your love. You've got to show, you've got to show your love. Say now, I keep shining like the sun will say. I keep shining like a rainbow around me. Keep shining like the sun will say now. Love keeps shining all around me. Say now, love.